Okay.
Progress.
Okay, votes are coming in. Good, keep them coming. And
I don't think they see me anymore, do they?
Couple more minutes.
It's in my ears. I don't want to turn it on, so I don't want to turn it on.
Okay, just under 2 minutes and we'll get started at 5:30.
Hello, doctor.
Hello there. Okay, so it is 5:30 and we will get started with our February PACE talk. And thank you all for joining, and thank you for joining precisely on time or before time as usual. So today, we are going to talk about a very interesting topic. But before we talk about the topic, I would like to share the results of the poll. So there are around about 32% of people who are new. So almost one third that have never attended a PACE talk. So I'll share with you what PACE talks are about. So PACE talks is a collaborative between a bunch of healthcare organizations and professionals in our community. This includes the hospital foundation, the community CHC at in Port Hope, the Northumberland Family Health Team, IMCARE, which is our practice, and also the community health the Northumberland Hospice, the Ed's House folks. So it is a collaborative effort. We started this just around 8 years ago to start conversations about things that were health related and could help people become more aware as well as involve change education. So that is the PACE name stands for Personalized Assessment and Change Education. It started off as a practice improvement project, but it has evolved into this collaborative thing. There are a couple of rules of PACE. Nobody gets paid or nobody can sponsor this. So this is, everybody here is a volunteer. Nicole, who is here in the background, has done all the promotion, is from the hospital, and she volunteers her time. The speakers are volunteers. They don't get paid. The same thing with me. So there's no exchange of money, and it has a zero cost footprint to any system or others. The second rule is these are conversation starters. These are not personal health advice or like, what should I take? What should I do kind of thing. And that is why I moderate these and make sure that we remain true to our mission. The third thing is we don't talk about government policy or, you know, system issues. This is more about information that you can learn and use. The way we figure out the topics is fairly straightforward. We ask you, people who have attended, to share what topics you would want to hear on. And then there's the small group that meets once a year and lists the topics that we think would make good sense and will be appropriate. So that is how we pick today's topic. Now, in terms of the second question, the question was, where do people get information currently? And I'll share these results with you, which right now, 0% get it from your regular doctors. In terms of other healthcare professionals, around about 60% of people get information from there on topics like microbiome or supplements or those kind of things. 21% is social media, 16% said Google search. Nobody said artificial intelligence or ChatGPT. And paid subscriptions, there were 5%. So that is the mix today. So I will stop sharing those and then move on to what we are going to talk about today. So today we are going to talk about something that is quite vast and it is evolving. This is, you know, what do you need to know literally about the microbiome? And the person who's going to shed light on this is Dr. Barbara Weiss. She's a naturopathic doctor. She has 20 years of experience. She is a doctor. She is a speaker. She is a health educator. And she is local. She's in Northumberland County. She's in Port Hope. So I will spotlight her and ask her to unmute herself and turn it over to you. The flow of this would be she will speak, then we will have Q&A session. Feel free to put in the questions in the chat box or raise your hand and we will call on you to ask the questions. So thank you, Barbara, for doing this. Over to you.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Bargava. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So I'm going to share my slides. So I just thought that it would be a topic that would be helpful to have something that goes alongside so that we can actually see it. So I'm just going to bring that up first. And just confirm that you can see it. And I think everybody's good to go. Great. Well, thank you very much for the introduction. The topic of the microbiome and how it affects health is certainly getting a lot of attention, and it's great to be able to speak on this topic because it's something that, as a naturopathic doctor, I've focused on it quite regularly in clinic, and it's been on our radar for a number of years now. But it's a very, very big area, and I'd like to talk, I could talk about it for a few hours, but I know we only have about 20 minutes. So I will be giving an overview of the interrelationship between the microbiome and the mood and how it affects our metabolism and immune system. But before we start, I thought it would be good to just get an understanding of what is the definition of the microbiome. So the microbiota really is the what we define as the actual microbe. So it could be bacteria, fungi, or viruses that live in and on us. And I use the analogy that it's like the musicians. But the microbiome itself is the microbes plus their genetic material and also the environment that they create. And also the theater and the music that they play. So it's a much broader context to it. Whereas dysbiosis is the disturbance or imbalance of in the microbial community, which is linked to, and you're going to see this in a few minutes, inflammation, metabolic issues, and also mood disorders. And I'll try to just explain a little bit about why that actually happens. Oops. Sorry about that. I didn't know which one is turning it. So where is it actually exists? You might be surprised that the microbiome composition, it really does depend on the different regions of the body, whether it's in our respiratory cavity or our skin, the oral microbiome, the gut, or the vagina. But we're going to be focused today on the gut microbiome. You might also be surprised to learn, or maybe you aren't surprised, but we're nearly equal partners. So our body contains pretty much the same number of microbes as it does human cells, 38 trillion bacteria versus 30 trillion human cells. It doesn't weigh very much. It's about 200 grams. They used to say that they thought it weighed about 5 or 6 pounds, but recent studies have shown that it's actually just about 200 grams for a 70 kilogram person. And it has a lot of continual chatter between your nervous system and your immune system and your metabolism. And it's very, very unique to you. It's almost like a fingerprint. It's shaped by your genetics, it's shaped by your diet, and it's also shaped by the environment that you live in. One thing that's important to understand is how we actually develop our microbiome. And I'd just like to show this because I think it's really interesting in the sense that some people don't understand how we actually develop the microbiome over time. So our first inoculation happens at birth, and it really depends on how you're born, if you were a vaginal birth or whether or not you were a C-section. And if you're a vaginal birth, you would have been colonized by the vaginal canal, but also the fecal microbes. And so your colonization happened right at birth. But if you're a C-section birth, you probably would have a very different composition right at the onset of birth, because it would mostly be coming from skin flora and also the environment that you're actually in. But it happens that colonization accelerates rather quickly. And so during the stages of 0 to 2, they start to develop quite a differentiation in the sense that it feeds Bifidobacterium from the breast milk. And also with the introduction of solid foods, we start to shift and see a little bit of more diversity. And then by the ages of 3 to 10, you start to see an adult-like profile. And your immune education starts to continue. So you're constantly educating the immune system just by the microbes that are inside you. And then, of course, when we hit our teenage years, there's a lot of remodeling that takes place because a lot of lifestyle factors change. So diet changes, sleep and stress changes. But also there's different metabolic demands. And that makes a big difference in terms of what's actually happening in terms of the microbes that are in there. And then by adult, what we start to see is that it's pretty much a stable environment, and it doesn't usually get too impacted by things other than diet and lifestyle, more so than an acute issue. So it's quite a stable environment by the time you are 18 and on. I just can't figure out why it's not. Sorry, I'm sorry about this, Dr. Vargava. I just can't get the slides advanced. There we go. So what does your gut microbiome actually do? Let's talk a little bit about it. It interacts with many different body systems, the digestive system. It interacts with the immune system. It interacts with the nervous system, the gut-brain axis, which we'll talk about, and also with your endocrine system, which is your hormones. And some healthcare providers and some researchers actually do consider it to be its own organ system, which is really interesting. But what we're going to focus on today, as I said, is mostly the gut. And the gut, just to have an understanding of how it interacts with the microbiome, it is the actual command center for the immune system and the nervous system. A lot of people don't realize it, but 70 to 80% of our immune cells actually reside in the gut. And we also have what we would consider the gut to be our second brain. We have more neurons than the spinal cord. And that's an important part because you're going to see how it actually interacts with the gut brain axis. And it's also the largest endocrine organ. So the it actually is the control center for your appetite and metabolism. And you see a lot of the activity happening just in the small intestine. So it's a very multifaceted system. It's not just about digestion. So what does the digestive system actually do? Well, it breaks down the things that we can't. So gut bacteria, when it resides in the gut, is actually helping to break down complex carbohydrates and digestive dietary fiber. So you can see on the left there, the dietary fiber intake comes in, the gut ferments it, and then it produces what we call a short-chain fatty acid. And we'll talk about short-chain fatty acids in just a minute, but it also synthesizes some vitamins like B1, B9, B12, and K. And it also supports fat digestion, and it helps to regulate our cholesterol levels. The immune system, this is another area where it actually has an impact. Digestion is one part of the story, but the immune system is a bigger part of the story. With 80%, 70 to 80% of our immune cells do live in the gut. And those gut microbes train their immune system. So a lot of times you've probably heard people that have autoimmune issues. A lot of times that's a system that's gone awry with respect to educating the immune system. So the immune system has started to recognize your own body as being a foreign invader, and it attacks it. And that's actually what an autoimmune condition actually is. And so we look to the gut microbes to understand where that, whether it was a virus that actually initiated that or what was the trigger. But our gut microbes really do play an important role in helping to train the immune system. And you can see that beneficial bacteria, they have a role to play because they compete or crowd out harmful bacteria. So if you had good bacteria in there in sufficient diversity and quantities, it's really, really hard for bad bacteria to exist because it gets crowded out by the good bacteria. And one other important thing that it does is it strengthens that gut barrier. And I just show an image of a leaky gut because leaky gut is a term that you may or may not have heard, but it's a real thing. And it has an implication with respect to why there could be systemic inflammation and why we start to see what we would call issues with respect to how we regulate our, not just our neurotransmitters, but even our hormones that control whether or not we feel full or not. So you can see with the short chain fatty acids that I mentioned earlier, it has a protective mechanism. The biggest thing that it does, and I'll just go back, it strengthens that, it strengthens the barrier. So it doesn't allow things to get into the bloodstream where your immune system can actually attack it. So certainly important that we have tight gap junctions, and the short chain fatty acids, as you'll see, is one of the biggest benefits of them is that it actually helps to protect the tight gap junctions. So it strengthens the gut barrier. It also, as I said, prevents toxins from getting into your bloodstream and also helps to reduce the inflammation. And we know that chronic inflammation, I'm sure that you've heard this, but a lot of chronic illness is linked to a chronic inflammatory process that goes on in the body. And the gut is more than digestion. There's also this connection between the gut and the brain, and some refer to it as the gut-brain axis, but the more applicable term is the microbiota gut-brain axis. And it is that connection, as you can see, between the gut, the microbiota, and then there's the nervous system connection, which is the vagus nerve that goes all the way up into the brain. And that's an important role because it does have a role to play with respect to the neurotransmitters that get produced by the gut bacteria and how it actually affects your mood. So how does it actually work? So that vagus nerve that I just showed you in that previous slide, and you can see it over here to the right, it's like a direct phone line. So the gut microbiota, it will produce a chemical. 80 to 90% of serotonin is actually made in the gut. It stimulates that vagus nerve and it sends a message up to the brain. And then what happens is you'll start to see an adjustment in mood or anxiety. And it's why we feel that butterfly sensation when we're nervous. There is that direct connection, and that's the gut-brain axis in action. It also has inflammation signals. So if gut microbes are unbalanced, or there's what we would call dysbiosis, it has a tendency to irritate the gut lining, and then that actually releases the inflammatory chemicals, and those chemicals can reach the brain. So some people will experience things like brain fog or low mood or even fatigue when they have a situation of gut dysbiosis. And the other place that it actually interacts is with our hormones or the endocrine system, the hormones and metabolism. And this is a really interesting area because it's an emerging area, but it's something that we're starting to see is that the gut microbes interact with the endocrine cells. And so they actually have a big role to play with blood sugar regulation. They influence our satiety hormones. They play a role to play with fat storage. They can either extract calories from the food, and some are more efficient at doing that than others. And when there's a dysbiosis, you see that there is a link between obesity and insulin resistance and diabetes. And it's an emerging area, but there's a lot of really solid research that's showing the connection between the two. One of the in animal studies, what they've done is they've taken mice that had no bacteria, so they were sterile mice, and they put the gut microbiome in of an obese mouse inside the sterile mouse, and the mouse became obese. And so we can see a causal relationship there. It's a little bit more difficult with humans to do a similar study because we can't ethically inject a person that is like we don't have a sterile human to inject a certain gut microbiome into to see this relationship. But the number of studies that show that there is a relationship is significant to allow us to then research it even further to understand the relationship between the two and how we can actually interplay with the gut microbiome to actually affect weight loss or even insulin resistance or whatever the metabolic dysfunction is, how we can actually improve upon that. So I like to use this slide as your microbiome is like a garden. We have a healthy gut microbiome. We feed it regularly with certain foods, and it grows a diversity of flowers and plants, and it maintains a healthy structure so that weeds and things like that can't grow in it. And on the right-hand side, we see illustrating like monoculture. So when there is no diversity there, it's an unhealthy environment and it just doesn't have that microbial diversity. So weeds start to grow and it doesn't have the same effect. So our goal really is to how do we actually feed our microbiome to get the best benefit out of it? So I'm just going to take you through where the microbiome can be disrupted. And I'm sure some of these factors might be things that you deal with regularly, but certain medications can actually disrupt the microbiome. We know that antibiotics have the effect of impacting our microbiome. Certain viruses, like even the SARS-CoV-2 and enteric viruses, like norovirus and things like that, can upset the microbiome. Surgeries, stress, sleep disruption, age and genetics, and even our lifestyle, like whether or not we're exercising or we lead a sedentary lifestyle, can actually affect the microbiome. So, what is the best way to support your microbiome? A lot of people talk and ask the question about probiotics and whether or not probiotics are something that they should actually take. And years ago, we used to think that probiotics actually would colonize a person's intestinal tract, but the reality is it doesn't. They're very transient. So they have a purpose and they have a time and place to be utilized. But our goal really is to feed the existing microbiome to develop diversity and to do it so that it stays with us and that we develop a healthier microbiome through foods and through other lifestyle factors so that it's creating that environment or the ecosystem where health is your beneficial health results come from that. So your best way to support your microbiome is to aim for 30 different plant foods per week. And we're not talking about servings, but actual plant types, whether it be vegetables, fruits, legumes, whole grains, even herbs and spices and some nuts and seeds, and typically either in raw form is better if you can. And increasing prebiotic fiber. So just to make that differentiation, prebiotic fiber is a fiber that feeds your good bacteria or feeds the beneficial bacteria. And there's a lot of foods that we consume on a regular basis that are considered to be a free prebiotic fiber. Things like oats, beans, lentils, onions and garlics, preferably in raw form, leeks, flaxseed, barley, apples, asparagus, and even some resistant starches that are things like potatoes that you cool for 4 hours in the fridge. It becomes a resistant starch, or even rice that you could cool and it would become a resistant starch. And those are prebiotic fibers that actually feed that beneficial bacteria to help create a nice ecosystem by using food. The other thing that you could do is to incorporate fermented foods. And it doesn't have to be a lot, but the key here is just to be consistent so that you're not going in spurts where you have a lot of these things once a week and then you don't eat like this for, you know, 5 out of 7 days, but you're eating like this 2 out of 7 days. You want to try and incorporate it into your diet every single day. And when it comes to the fermented foods, you don't need a lot. Even a forkful is sufficient. Things like kefir or sauerkraut or kimchi or miso or tempeh or even yogurt. You can make yogurt at home that has live cultures in it. Those are all really good fermented foods. Probiotics, as I said, in certain situations, they do have a time and place. They're important during and after antibiotic treatment. If somebody has a traveler's diarrhea or if they have some type of diarrhea that's caused by pathogenic bacteria, or if there's slow motility, there is a time and place for them, but it's not the number one way to increase or support your microbiome. And the diet that's most researched to support a healthy microbiome is the Mediterranean style diet. So eating vegetables at most meals, incorporating fish weekly, eating legumes several times a week, having raw olive oil as your main fat, it's a monounsaturated fat, eating fermented foods regularly and having whole grains instead of refined. So obviously not the standard American diet. We want to have a very whole food from the plant or has a mother, like a whole food diet really does help to support a healthy microbiome. So some of these things that you can do building daily, you could add one from each group every day. So whether it be root vegetables, greens, and in an older adult, usually greens are tolerated better, lightly steamed, not eating raw. But dandelion, chard, kale, arugula, beet greens, obviously arugula is not cooked, but beet greens, fresh herbs, beans like lentils or chickpeas or white beans or split peas, they really do help to grow that longevity bacteria. Fermented, so it helps to reseed your microbes. So again, as I mentioned, some of the fermented foods, like even fermented pickles, kimchi or yogurt, and also increasing colorful vegetables and fruits. So things that have really good, strong pigments in them, like berries, but also increasing things like cabbage, squash, tomatoes, and peppers. You want to increase diversity. And then also to stabilize the ecosystem, incorporating seeds in green tea, so the polyphenols. So things like green tea and even some of the seeds, like they contain polyphenols, which also helps to feed the microbiome. But just as important as diet, the other parts that really do affect the microbiome is having a good sleep schedule, getting and stabilizing the sleep schedule so that you go to bed at a regular time every day, that you try to get a good quality sleep in at least 8 hours. It does help to stabilize the rhythms of the microbiome. And there's research that has shown that physical activity really does help to increase the butyrate producers, which feeds the microbiome. Spending time outdoors, getting into the garden, it does help to increase your microbial diversity, and managing stress, because chronic stress does really reduce the beneficial species. So just to kind of bring it down to what are we looking for? We're really looking for diversity. If you look again to that diagram that I had about the garden, you want a diverse ecosystem because it's going to be more resilient. It's going to be able to withstand shock and disturbances. It's going to be an efficient resource for extracting nutrients, and it really does have a strong foothold to resist those pathogens, opportunistic bacteria or infections that come into that present to us. And when you have the low diversity, you're a lot more fragile and you're more susceptible to having pests or bacteria like Clostridium difficile or H. pylori that can actually take root in the system and cause or disrupt the microbiome. And so that's very, very important. And the other thing that I would say is if you focused on one thing that you could take away, it would be to add in like the 30 different types of plants per week, but also adding in and paying attention to things like prebiotic fiber, the fermented foods, prebiotic fiber and fiber itself, aiming for 25 to 30 grams of fiber is really ideal to really strengthen that microbiome. And really prioritizing your sleep, your movement, and finding ways to manage stress because it does actually impact directly that microbial composition. Here's just some references, and I think that's pretty much it. Dr. Bhargava? Oh, you're just on mute, so.
I will unmute. So thank you, Dr. Weiss, so for that excellent thing. And we'll open it up for questions. And if you could
take it off
come
here.
Up with your screen, you know, yeah, that would be
there
good.
We go.
So now people
okay.
can see yeah. you. So, Barbara, you talked about the microbiome, that it matures and it's done by age 18, that it is stable.
Relative.
Now, if you look around the room that is in here, most of us are way past 18. So is the boat already sailed for us, or these sleep and taking these things can change our microbiome above those of us who are above 50 at least?
Oh, no. You still have, there still is a lot that you can actually do. A couple of things, like if you think of the analogy that you're feeding a garden, the microbiome as you age, there is a genetic component to it and there is a history that's there, but your goal is to give it instruction for what to do. So how you do that is by feeding it the right foods. So making sure that you, again, I'll go back to adding or incorporating into plant-based foods, 30 different plant types per week is a good goal. It seems like a lot, but it's actually not that difficult to do when you break it down. And really trying to incorporate some of the fermentable, like the prebiotic fibers or the fermentable fibers, and eating it consistently. You know, fiber, there was a lot of talk of fiber years ago, and then for whatever reason, it kind of went by the wayside for a number of years. There's a lot of talk about fiber again, about the importance of helping to lower cholesterol. But more importantly, I would say, not just more importantly, I would say it's equally important, is that it really does feed that microbiome. So if we can use that fermentable carbohydrate to increase the short chain fatty acids or butyrate, then those, the butyrate production actually really does help with balancing the microbiome, but also preventing things like inflammation and preventing, and so it has an impact on your brain and it has an impact on other aspects of your body like blood sugar regulation and other things like that. So there's absolutely, you can change the microbiome within 14 days. If you're concentrating on getting, they see changes when they've done studies. If people are consistently trying to get a diversity of plant-based foods in there, you can see the changes in the microbiome in as early as 12 to 14 days.
Okay, great. So let's get some questions from the chat. So Linda Nicole asked, how can we increase short-chain fatty acids?
Through the incorporation of the fiber. So I mentioned to Dr. Bhargava before, I do have a handout that I'm going to be posting on the talk that does talk about how to incorporate fiber into the diet and how, what makes up a prebiotic fiber? What makes up a, what are the different sources of fiber and things like that? But inulin is a really big source of prebiotic fiber. Jerusalem artichokes, like sunchokes, are a big source of fiber, like a prebiotic fiber. Some people take a fiber supplement, but you can get a lot of it just through your food. So the handout will be up tomorrow, but the foods that you're eating probably in your diet already, I don't know if I can pull up the slide, but the biggest source of a prebiotic fiber would be considered to be inulin. And inulin is in a lot of different foods that we eat.
So if I were to say, what did you eat in the last 24 hours that had inulin, Barbara?
For me, onions and garlic. Okay. So onions and garlic in a raw form.
Right.
Preferably in a raw form. There is still some inulin in when it's cooked, but better in a raw form.
Right.
And the like any type of vegetable that has like I always think to things like kohlrabi or turnip or I don't know what if people experience it, but some people get gassy when they eat certain types of vegetables. That typically is a sign that it has a higher amount of inulin in it. And despite something like broccoli or some of the cruciferous vegetables, but something that actually makes you have a little bit more, gas, like kohlrabi or turnips or, I'm just drawing a blank right now, but it's, I'll go through my list and push it out for you. So,
okay, great.
I just have it here. I had a slide on it, but I don't know if I can pull it up or not.
That's okay.
Okay.
So Jennifer Darrell asked, if the potato and rice have to be cooled,
yes,
can they be eaten warm and reheated?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Which is interesting, right? Because what happens when you, so you just have to cool it ideally for 4 hours in the refrigerator. And then by reheating it, it doesn't change the composition. It will remain a resistant starch. So there is a girl, she's a French biochemist named Jessie Chappelle, and she wrote a book called The Glucose Revolution. And she talks a lot about the resistant starch in her book, but it's interesting because resistant starch doesn't get digested in the small intestine. It goes all the way down to the colon to actually get fermented by the bacteria there. So that's why it's an excellent form of increasing your short-chain fatty acids and butyrate, which have that really solid effect at helping to make sure that the barrier of the gut is not stays intact and doesn't become a leaky gut. But yeah, resistant starch, you just have to put it in the fridge for 4 hours. It has a really different effect on blood glucose. It still isn't, you know, if you had diabetes or if you had type 1 or type 2 diabetes and carbohydrates are probably limited in your diet, it is one way if you wanted to have it periodically to decrease the load of glucose is to make it a resistant starch. So by putting it in the fridge for 4 hours and then taking it out and reheating it does make a difference.
So in the same space, Barbara, of heating and reheating,
yeah,
heating is associated with sterilization. You
yes.
heat things, you boil things, and they get... So does heating and cooking, so if I were to prepare a stir fry and it's
yes.
high temperature, and will that kill the helpful bacteria?
Well, it's not like... no, because it's not like you are, no, what's happening there is it's the fiber that's in the food that is feeding the bacteria. So the bacteria is already in your gut.
Right.
So when you're cooking the food, you're still providing the substrate of fiber to the gut for it to ferment.
And so in these fermented foods, et cetera, it is not that you're taking the bacteria from outside in and growing your garden. You're not seeding the garden with fresh food, is that?
Yeah. So the way that I would look at it is if it's a fermented food, it obviously is going to have a microbiota right. component to it, and it will help to continue to feed your own microbiome. But if you're talking about food as the source, it's the fiber that becomes the food source for the bacteria that's already in your gut. And so if we have, if we have dietary fiber, that's why, like, if you had oats, it's breaking down. The microbiome is, it's using the fiber, the fermentable fiber, in order to produce more bacteria. And that's what's actually helping with the short chain fatty acids to keep the gut lining intact. So it, the cooking is not making a difference in terms of the microbiome. It's the fiber that it's using for feeding.
So then there were a few questions. Will the presentation be available? The handouts? Yes, yes.
Yes,
and that is where Nicole Marotti, who is from NHH, will be doing that. So then let's come to a question between relation between arthritis and microbiome.
Okay.
So this is from Linda Nickel. Is arthritis related to microbiome?
There's a connection. Let's put it that way. We used to think of inflammation as like systemic inflammation, more like joint inflammation. But now we realize that it's a much broader, it's much broader than that, and that the inflammation starts with the gut. So there is that connection. Age-related chronic inflammation has its own name called inflammaging. So it's a different process than what we used to think. It's persistent low-grade inflammation that activates the immune system. And so it does start with the gut. So sometimes people wonder, if I altered my microbiome, will it change the inflammatory process that's going on in my body? And the answer is yes. Mm-hmm. We often see, what I often see clinically is when somebody actually changes the gut microbiome by the way in which they're eating, what ends up happening is those inflammatory markers come down, and the systemic inflammation markers like C-reactive protein and things like that start to decline, because it's correcting itself through the action in the gut. Mm. So the short answer is yes, that it does have an impact. The microbiome does play a role with arthritis, like the inflammatory arthritis, yes.
So C. Alger has a question that if for some reason you cannot take insoluble fiber because of gut issues or problems in the gut from the past, is soluble fiber the same as insoluble fiber?
No, soluble fiber and insoluble fiber are different. Like soluble fiber, insoluble fiber is like the roughage, like it can't break down. And so it's almost like it kind of sweeps through the gastrointestinal tract and kind of clears it out, but it might provide bulk for the purpose of a stool. Soluble fiber is something that can be like absorb water and dissolve. Like it, so it actually acts as a food source for the microbiota, but so does the other, but it's, they're very, very different. So was the question, you can't take soluble fiber or you can't take insoluble fiber? Which one?
Insoluble.
Insoluble fiber.
Yeah. Cannot take insoluble fiber.
Okay. So it just causes grief if you have insoluble fiber.
Prior colon problem. So,
right. So you could still, you still get benefit from the soluble fiber. There is a benefit for both components of it, but soluble fiber is where we get a lot of the benefit for the microbiome.
Okay. Good. And then Deborah McCarthy asked, how much of our fiber intake needs to come from raw fruits and vegetables to improve the microbiome?
From raw fruits and vegetables, raw or just fruits and vegetables in general?
Raw fruits and vegetables was the question. And
And I would say it depends on your age, like, and only because what can your system actually handle? So like I said, with the aging microbiome, so as we age, our microbiome ages as well. Some people can't tolerate some raw fruits. Like they might not even be able to tolerate a raw apple, but they can have a cooked apple. Mm-hmm. Or they can't have raw kale, but they can have cooked kale. So I think it really depends. The key is that you're getting a variety of the foods, whether it be cooked or raw. And again, the goal is really to get 30 different plant-based types of foods over the course of a week. So adding in something every day, whether it's a legume every day, whether it's a grain every day, and adding in some fruit and vegetables every single day. Like you want to try and to create diversity by having it and being consistent with it every single day. But the magic number for what I would say is you're aiming for about 30 different plant foods, which would be vegetables and fruits, but it also would incorporate seeds and things like that, and even spices.
Great. And I think that is the last question coming from Jennifer Darrell asking, I don't see string beans on the bean list. Are they equally
Oh,
beneficial?
yeah, string beans are also beneficial. Like beans, like general beans, yeah, they can be
Okay.
beneficial. Yeah, they're on the other list that I'm putting up for the handout that will be on the website. And
Great.
just to go back, can I just go back to the
Yeah.
prebiotic foods? Because I just pulled up my slide just so that we have it. So the things that I missed, so things like apples, dandelion greens are a prebiotic food and actually a big prebiotic food. Asparagus, green bananas, legumes, apples, even oats, and like I said, Jerusalem artichokes, like sunchokes is what some people call them, but Jerusalem artichokes are a big source of inulin.
Great. And oh, I think, is there anything? No, just a thank you for informative talk. So it sounds like that the microbiome is an evolving space. There's more information coming, and there's a lot that one can do themselves,
Yes. Yeah.
by reading and educating themselves and know. And I would also add that medicine and all these science things start off with one size fits all. We say, oh, everybody should do blank.
Right.
But often what we find is there are certain things that you can do and there are certain things that are helpful, and then there are other things that the same person can't do. Like, why does somebody can eat a lot of X food and not have any trouble and the other person will have? Is
Right.
it microbiome related? Is it your anatomy related? So that is still to come. Are there any books or recipe books that people can that you have found useful that you can say, okay, if I want to improve my microbiome, here's a recipe book that I can cook or make or eat, kind of thing, like a balanced diet? Or is it just a Mediterranean diet and you're on your way?
I would focus on the Mediterranean diet. Like there's a lot of correlation, like when we're talking about the gut-brain connection and things like that and its impact for mental health and prevention of dementia and things like that. Even the MIND diet is very similar to the Mediterranean diet. But the Mediterranean diet has the most research to support a healthy microbiome. And any book that sort of focuses on fresh foods, lots of variety of vegetables and fruits, lots of spices and other things like onions and garlics and garlic and things like that, and olive oil. Like it's a very strong basis. And the Mediterranean diet is not a difficult diet to follow. Like a lot of people eat a Mediterranean diet without realizing it because they're eating a whole food diet. I would say one caveat I would say is that anytime you're introducing any type of fiber, you have to go low and slow. So you can't all of a sudden start introducing like Jerusalem artichoke, for example, a lot of it in one day. You'll feel uncomfortable. And even if you were to incorporate, there are supplements like of resistant starch and even prebiotic fibers that you can buy, but you always have to go low and slow because tolerance has to be built. You're going to get a really gassy at the beginning until the microbiome kind of evens itself out. But you have to kind of work yourself up to it and like work over time in order to ensure that the microbiome has time to balance and that you're not feeling uncomfortable about it. We all know that beans have an impact on some people, and soaking them or usually can help to increase the ability to tolerate them. But you're right, everybody has a different tolerance to some of these things, and so it's very individual.
And so Linda Nichols said, just finished a Lifestyle RX government-sponsored 12-week program that had a similar message to this. Changed my A1C from 6.1 to 5.4 in 12 weeks. There we go.
Excellent.
Good work. So I was thinking somebody will ask this question, but somebody hasn't. So I will ask this question. Is alcohol a fermented food?
Well, alcohol has polyphenols. Well, it depends on what alcohol.
Well, any, you know,
let's say,
like
let's say,
beer, you know, wine, like
no, I wouldn't like,
scotch.
So yeah, because it has, it does have a particular type of yeast-based organism in it. Like the, like it does have a, you know, whether it's beer or whether it's brewer's yeast or it's baker's yeast, but brewer's yeast, but it's, I would say, let's just go back to wine, for example. So red wine is a polyphenol. Red wine does have polyphenols in it. That's why, you know, some people say Italians have better health in some ways because they drink a lot of red wine and it's high in polyphenols. Grapes are high in polyphenols, and polyphenols actually have, and so does dark chocolate, has a big effect as well on the microbiome. But alcohol itself, I wouldn't say that it has a good microbial divert, like as a fermented food that you would use as a, like you would use like something like kefir, for example.
Yes.
It doesn't have that impact.
Now, the current guidelines, at least the experts in nutrition, alcohol is down to zero, like no alcohol.
Yes,
Like
yeah.
Previously it was one, two drinks, and maybe
yeah.
this is preventive or those. It is like down to zero.
Yeah.
And I think cannabis is no research as far as I've seen that there's no research
No.
about folks who do cannabis or others. What does it do to those? So great. I don't see any other questions. And
Okay.
Barbara, thank you for taking the time. Thank you for
Yeah, no
volunteering,
problem.
because that is what makes our community great. And, you know, I think the recording went smoothly, so we should have the recording and we'll get that. And we'll keep the conversations going. And please feel free to email me. You have my email for suggestions of topics. And even speakers. So if you know of somebody who has is knowledgeable about something and that you may want to hear or other you think others should hear, bring it up and we'll come across and do those things. So thank you and have a good night.
Thank you. Thanks,
Yeah.
everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.